there. Welcome to LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Nathan Fox. I'm one of the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, which is called Thinking LSAT. With me is Francesca Civilotti. Francesca is a former Demon student and now does some teaching slash tutoring for the Demon. How are you doing, Francesca?
I'm great. How are you?
I am good. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about your story before we get into this email? Where did you come from? How did you study? What did you end up scoring on the official test?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm an undergraduate student. I go to Dalhousie, so I'm Canadian. I'm in Halifax. I've only taken the official LSAT once, and I started with the Khan Academy program, and I'm not actually what you guys would call a refugee. I didn't go to Princeton or any of those. I was pretty lucky to find you guys right off the bat because I'm a big podcast person. So that's actually how I found the Demon in the first place.
Okay. Yeah.
And I started listening to the podcast. I really liked how you guys saw the test. And so I started with the free account, and then I did the basic account, and then I took the August test, and I scored a 176. I came up from a diagnostic that was about 25 points slower, and I
attributed
that all to you guys. So,
well, I mean, we can help you to see how the test makes sense, but I mean, you're 95% responsible because you are the one that did the work. How many practice tests do you think you did?
Well, I studied for about 3.5 months, and I took one practice test every week. So whatever that works out to.
Yeah, I mean, so you're looking at 15 to 20 full practice tests, plus, I mean, how many extra questions or sections did you do?
A lot of those.
A lot, yeah, okay. How did you use the Demon?
I really liked the drilling feature. That was what drew me in, I guess. I went to some of the classes. Yeah, I'm a really big fan of how you always talk about just being consistent and kind of like even just an hour every day. At the start of my studying, it was much more than that because I thought, oh, I only have so much time. I need to, you know, make all these gains. But then I realized that, and this is what you guys are always talking about, but that past a certain amount of time, you're not really getting out that much more than what you're putting in. It's diminishing returns. And what's really important is just having however many hours you can afford to put in every day or almost every day, and just focused studying time and quality studying where you're really working through every single question. You're understanding everything, even the ones that you got wrong. You're understanding why everything, all the correct answers are right and all the wrong answers are wrong, and using the ask button as well for anything that's not clear. Just putting in the work, but not just working hard, but working smart and being efficient about it.
Yeah, I love that. You know, if you can learn one thing every day, like, and what I really mean is a question that you missed, it doesn't make any sense to you right now, but if you can grapple with it and figure out why the right answer is right and why the wrong answer is wrong and have it really click where you just really, you know, where you would be like, oh, yeah, I could explain this to my mom, you know, that, like, where it's like, no, it makes perfect sense. Like, it can be quirky, it can be tricky, but ultimately, eventually, it makes perfect sense. And when you get to that click, then that's forward progress. And the thing about the drilling that's so useful is you can drill one question, figure it out, really understand it. And if that's all you have time for right now, I feel like you have made progress. And now one question a day isn't going to be enough, but like an hour a day is enough to be grinding and be moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I totally agree. And some questions, I think they really make you work for it. Even I think, especially when you get into like 165 plus, there are some questions, the ones that are you're going to spend most of your energy on that are going to really make you work for having that moment where it just kind of clicks together and you explaining it to your mother or feeling like you could explain it to a six-year-old. But that's where the things like the ask button or the lessons, that's where that really comes in and seeing somebody else's perspective on it. Because I think that you can read explanations online for the questions and you can still be like, okay, yep, got it, and not understand a single thing.
That's totally true. I mean, people who are real passive in their prep aren't going to make as much progress, right? Like if you just sit back in class and let me explain it and go, yeah, okay. But really all you're doing is like letting me bullshit you, you know, like it's just the bluster. Like I say it, like I believe it. I mean, I do, I really believe it. And so I'm saying it the way that I believe it and it makes sense to me, but it has to make sense to you. And so that's what I really want from a student is somebody who's willing to push back and go, well, wait a second now, that I don't quite get it. And it's always those little questions like that people say, hey, you said this, but doesn't this mean this other thing? And then if I can clarify that for you, then you can see how it actually does make perfect sense.
Yeah.
Right. It's almost like learning this. It's not a new language because it's just English, but it's the way that they use the English, you know, in a very precise and lawyerly type of a way.
Yeah. And once you do enough questions, the test gets kind of repetitive in a way. You see the patterns and you see, oh, this is the kind of the same question in a different context than what I've seen a thousand times.
Hey, it ain't kind of repetitive in a way. It is extremely repetitive. I mean, when you're properly prepared, your reaction to the LSAT is going to be, oh God, again. Oh man, you're going to confuse sufficient for necessary again, or you're going to confuse correlation for causation again. Like that's the thousandth time I've seen this. And it's basically free points for the people who are prepared.
Yeah.
All right. You want to dive into this email from Lou? I'll let you read it if you don't mind.
Yeah, for sure. Let's do it. All right. Lou says, hi, here are some questions I had for the show. What do you take away from a logic game and how do you apply it in the next?
What do you think?
That's an interesting way to ask that question. I think what Lou is getting at is sort of how do the skills from mastering one game apply to the next? I think that part of it is practicing that process of really mastering and really understanding what every single rule means, what every single deduction that you can make from that. I mean, part of that is getting the process of learning the games down, the process of not just jumping into the answer choices until you really understand the setup and all the rules. I mean, like we were talking about before, when you do enough questions, the LSAT does get repetitive. And there are definitely some games, especially in the older tests, where it's like, oh, okay, this is like a new unexpected thing, or this is different from what we've done before. But when you really get down to it, there's only so many things that the logic game section is asking you to do. So I think it's pretty easy to be like, these are the takeaways from this type of games. And even if you don't need to constantly be saying, oh, this is this type of game, this is this type of game, you can still work those skills and those approaches into whatever future games you encounter.
Yeah, they're constantly subtly tweaking the games. They constantly evolve. They constantly change. I don't find it useful at all to categorize. I don't think that people need to be naming and categorizing and memorizing taxonomies or whatever. That said, if you practice games a lot, you're going to realize that the patterns are repeating themselves and it's just kind of the same type of shit, but with some subtle changes. The one thing that I would like to remind Lou is that they are always, I think this is the most important thing to take away from any logic game. They always give you 100% of the information that you need to answer every single question perfectly. That's what I want you to take away from that game. Always. I want you to realize, I want you to see it. Like you're not done with that game if you haven't yet realized that they have given you all the information you need to answer every single question perfectly. So I want you to be able to solve every single question perfectly on every single logic game you ever do.
And that's what's so key about the drilling tools, that you can, without the time pressure, I mean, the timing should be the last thing that comes, I think.
Right, I agree.
I mean, when you're drilling and when you're encountering a game for the first time, or maybe it's not the first time that you've done it, there's no time pressure. And what matters is not getting it fast right away. It's first you need to, like you said, understand the entire setup and understand it perfectly and know that with all the information you're given, everything you need is there. And no matter how much time it takes you, get to the answer first and then realize, okay, what other approaches could have gotten me there maybe more efficiently? how else could somebody see the same problem that's yep. more experienced than me?
Yeah, I would look for, I mean, step one is, can you perfectly answer every question? Like, can you get there? Can you find it? And then the next question is, okay, could you have found it? Not like trying to go fast, but could you have found it more efficiently? And what that frequently involves is making a better setup in the first place, almost always including worlds. I mean, I'm probably doing worlds on like 80% of my games. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I find that maybe not 80%, but for especially for certain games, I find that the terminology that I would use is that sometimes worlds just kind of emerge, where when I'm trying to understand the setup, I'm kind of keeping track of the different rules that get triggered in different combinations. And I'm realizing, okay, well, when, you know, this particular letter name is involved, there's always all these other rules that get triggered. So in my mind, I'm like, I can't keep track of this anymore. I need to write down this scenario, like scenario one, world one versus world two. Like you kind of, as you work through the yeah. set or the questions, it comes out to you.
We do this all the time in real life. I mean, it's part of how we solve our day to day. Like think about your calendar, right? And I mean, Logic games have calendars frequently. They'll have days or months or whatever, right? So see if you can buy this example, Francesca. I have to go to CarMax. I have to get rid of my car and get a different car from CarMax, right? So I got to go to CarMax and I'm thinking, well, I really need to get this done today or tomorrow. And then there are all kinds of other restrictions in my life. Like I had to talk to an electrician today because I have shit that's broken, and I had to talk to you and record this podcast episode, and I have a bunch of writing that I have to do, and I have other errands that I need to run. And so one way of thinking about it is, hey, there's a world in which I go to CarMax today, and there's a world in which I go to CarMax tomorrow, but I know that I'm going to go to CarMax either today or tomorrow. So I can think about those two solution sets to my life. Like I might go this way, I might go that way, but I am going to do one of those two things.
Yeah.
Then I can start to think about the other restrictions in my life, the other stuff that I need to do, the writing, the recording, the podcasting, talking to the electrician, whatever else I got, the other errands, whatever else I got going on. And I can think about how it would fit to do those other things in the world in which I go to CarMax today and in the world in which I go to CarMax tomorrow. And so it's like these, and that's very much like a logic game. I could absolutely write a logic game that included exactly that scenario.
I think there are actually a lot of skills on the LSAT that the test that you use on the test when you use these different types of questions that are super transferable in the real life. Another example that comes to mind is logical reasoning. I mean, how many times are you in an argument with somebody and you hear them respond with their argument, and while they're talking, you're already thinking all the ways that they're wrong and that their argument is dumb. And yeah. if you can just take that skill and be like, well, on the LSAT, it's not that different. I mean, if I'm reading this, like you're saying before, like attacking it and already being like, this is probably going to be a bad argument. You're yeah. a mile ahead to begin with.
Let's see if we can get through the rest of Lou's email. He's got a bunch of other questions here. Why don't you read this second bullet point?
Sure. I was helping my son with his RC homework. He has to read some short paragraphs of very easy sentences and answer questions. No arguments, just a set of facts. He was struggling with one on history, so I asked him to read one paragraph out loud. In that paragraph was one of the answers to one of the questions. He read it clearly, and when I asked him what the answer was, he didn't know. I asked him to give me what the paragraph was about in his own words, and he had completely forgotten what he just read. I asked him to read it again, but this time to figure out the purpose of the paragraph and for him to tell me in his own words what it was about. He read it silently and blurted out, ooh, when he figured out the answer on his own.
Okay, sounds pretty familiar.
Yeah, definitely. I learned from your show that just because you can see the letters and pronounce the words clearly, even the fancy words, does not mean that you really read the passage. Maybe there's a pearl in there somewhere, but the point was made to a fifth grader. Just because your eye can track a sentence and pronounce the words you see in your head or out loud does not mean you are engaging the passage. It's almost like there are two types of reading. Like when you get called on to read out loud for class and panicked and practiced the few sentences you had to make sure you got it right. You didn't absorb the sentences, you simply pronounced them right, fighting back a shaky voice. Then there's the class note from a crush. You read that in your head and absorbed everything. You knew what it was about the moment you were done. Thoughts?
Okay. I don't know. What do you think?
I like this. It felt a little bit meta because I was reading that simultaneously trying to engage with what was being said and also trying to pronounce everything right.
Right. Yeah, totally. I guess if we're talking about reading comprehension particularly, people need to, there's reading with scare quotes, and then there's real reading where you actually understand it. And I think a lot of what people do when they are reading, they think they're reading it, but really all they're doing is skimming it. Like they're going over the words and they might perfectly pronounce each word and each sentence, but then they get to the end and you go, what did that just say? And they're like, and then they go back to it and they start reading it again from the beginning. Yeah. No. If you read it properly, I should be able to take it away from you. I used to do this back in the day. I would have somebody read a reading comprehension passage. I'd be like, okay, you read it? You're good? And then I would take it away from them. And I would say, okay, what was the main point? And they would be like totally lost. Like they'd have no idea what the main, and then it's like, well, then I give it back to them. And I'd be like, listen, if I can't ask you what was the main point of that passage, if you can't answer that without referring back to the passage, then you just didn't get it. You're not really reading it.
I think that happens all the time. I mean, it's like the difference
between
reading for class when you have to read the same sentence three times, or even when you're just reading when you're really tired. It happens all the time. And it's not necessarily that you're a bad reader or anything. It's just that you're not actively engaging with the passage. And it's difficult. I mean, when I started studying for the LSAT, I would get to like a new passage on RC and I'd be like, okay, and this is the part where I read. And then I would start reading and then I would get halfway through and I would be like, I have absorbed none of this. You know, it happens all the time.
Yeah. Oh, super, super common. Lou's next question, he's asking for my opinion about law school for politics. I don't really have an opinion on that. You need to go talk to politicians and ask them if law school is a good idea for politics. I have no idea whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. Why don't you read this last question, Francesca, from Lou?
For sure. What is considered progress? I went from finishing 3 games but missing 3 to 4 in each game to only finishing 1 or 2 games with 100% accuracy. Is that progress or something else?
What do you think?
I think that's a pretty easy question. I think that's totally progress. It comes down to what you're always saying, slowing down to speed up. And if you can start out by mastering the games and in more time with 100% accuracy, and you do that over and over again, it's just going to happen that you're going to get faster. It comes down to practice, but not just any practice of rushing through things and convincing yourself that you understand the explanations, but just really being slow and being meticulous and needing to completely master every single game.
It's lawyer shit. You either do or do not arrive at the correct answer. You know, like lawyers are not allowed to just make mistakes. That's not a thing. You hire a lawyer because you want somebody who's going to get it right. So on the logic games, you know, sometimes students think they're doing great because they're doing 3 games, but missing 3 to 4 in each game. And there's only 6 questions in each game on average. So, you know, if that's what you're doing, you're just not doing it.
Another thing I would add is that it might be confusing because it looks like you're getting the same score from getting 50% of each game versus getting 50% of the games. But one of those strategies is conducive to long-term improvement and the other is kind of just a waste of time.
Yeah, beautifully put. If you can do less, but actually solve each question, you can then randomly guess, by the way, on the questions that you're not attempting, and you're going to get 1 out of 5 of those right anyway. Lou was getting like 1 out of 3 or 1 out of 2 right on the ones that he was attempting. So all those mistakes, he doesn't even get to guess on those. He's just missing those questions. He thought he did them, but he didn't really do them. So he got 0 points. And Francesca makes a beautiful point, which is if you do less, but you do it accurately, then you're positioning yourself for long-term improvement. If you do more and continue to half-ass it, well, then you're not really doing it. You're not actually solving those questions. So you're much less likely to improve.
Totally agree.
Okay, cool. Francesca Civilotti is a former LSAT Demon student and a teacher with us now. You can come find her in LSAT Demon classes. You can email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.